Thanks for tuning in to PolitiTalk with Lane Palmer. Today on my show, we have a guest named Jack. So Jack, as always, as we start out, tell me a little bit about yourself and how you came to have the political mindset that you do.
Sure. Well, how much time do you have? I'm a native of Columbus, Ohio. Grew up on the east side. Pretty typical upper middle class suburban upbringing. Attended Bexley High School and then Wittenberg University for college. And growing up, I grew up in a pretty conservative and religious household, you know, pretty traditional. Was raised with, you know, Rush Limbaugh and Fox News on TV all the time. So I think that definitely has something to do with my early political foundations. And also just the kind of the world events, you know, our generation kind of growing up, being born in the late 90s and then, you know, living through 9/11, a couple wars, you know, global financial recession and, man, just all that's happened in the past year in 2020, of course. So I think that it seems like the past 20 to 30 years has just been like warp speed. It's almost like you kind of have to have a political opinion on all of these things. And as I think they've also kind of contributed to this hyper political atmosphere that we're in today. But back to my story. So I went to Wittenberg University where I plan on being a business major. I never really had any idea what I wanted to get into long term. But really took one political science class that I really enjoyed, and it was a political philosophy class, and it kind of got me into the old liberalism, classical liberalism philosophies from the 19th century and kind of the founding thinkers that really sparked a lot of the foundations for a lot of the Western society, like our founding documents here in the United States and also France and the United Kingdom. And I really kind of got fascinated with like the John Locke's and John Stuart Mill's and all those Jacqueline Rousseau and all those kind of old school thinkers. So that really sparked my interest, kind of getting that background. And so I decided to major in political science, not really having any idea what I wanted to do with it. Also, you know, studying political science also helps you question a lot of your beliefs that you're raised with. And it forces you to defend a lot of them and make new arguments and kind of build off of your old belief system. And I thought that was really good for me. So I, you know, some of my convictions grew stronger, some of them changed, kind of depends on the issue. But overall, I just kind of set the goal for myself where I just want to be as consistent as possible, logically on every political stance that I want to have. And it's okay not to have a political stance on some things, you know. I think it's good to always keep an open mind on things that you don't know about and just always be willing to learn new information. So I guess I have to credit my education to that particular piece. I had some good friends who went and worked in the state legislature after college here in Ohio, and they encouraged me to do the same. They thought it would be a good opportunity for me. I didn't really have any other post-college plans, so I started an internship one summer while at Wittenberg as a page of the Ohio House of Representatives, and I really enjoyed it. I was working for the Republican caucus at the time, and then went back to Wittenberg, finished up there in 2017, and then shortly afterwards, I started a fellowship program with the Legislative Services Commission here in Ohio, and LSE, as they're called. They're a nonpartisan research groups that they're paid by the state. They're a state agency essentially, but their main job is to provide accurate information to the elected officials, the lawmakers on the legislative branch, so that they can make as well informed decisions as possible when they're making when they're drafting bills and voting on legislation and whatnot. So through that program, I got connected with a lot of different lawmakers from around the state and a lot of people working for state agencies, and I kind of got my feet wet in learning how kind of state government operates. And the more I learned, the more I really enjoyed it. I was working for probably three different elected officials at the time, and as an aide in their offices, and you know, working that job really taught me how to. It really emphasized the customer service aspect of government. I think it's overlooked a lot of times. I'm a big proponent of, state and local government. I think is definitely the best government. Any branch that is the most responsive to the people, you know, I think is definitely the legislative branch. So I'm a big advocate of the legislative branch, and I think just the more people can learn about how to change things in their own city, in their own neighborhood, and in their own county and state, you know, that's really the best way to go about things and seeing what you want done in the world. So I continued working there for a couple of years, and then just constituents call up the phone and they have a problem, and you know, maybe they want a stop sign changed in their city and it's on a state route, so you have to call the Department of Transportation and look at it. You know, that's something that just one example of the kind of stuff I learned about, but also just kind of learning the legislative process and how it is difficult to change the law as it should be. I definitely enjoyed the policy into things a lot more than the political arm of the thing. But I ended up getting a new job at the beginning of last year, which was a pretty crazy time to start any new job, but I kind of continued the customer service theme. So I've always worked like customer service related jobs in my life, but I manage client relations at a small lobbying firm in Columbus, and it's called the Batchelder Company, and named after former Speaker of the House Bill Batchelder, who was term limited. And I really enjoyed so far. I just kind of when they hired me, they kind of emphasized this theme of being truthful and honest and having integrity in the institution, and trying to better Ohio through kind of a different lens than inside the state government. So 2020 was kind of a difficult time to start, like I said, but just because state government kind of came to a standstill, and no one was really meeting. And then we get, huge budget projected shortfall, which ended up not being as bad as we thought it was going to be. But, having all these new people out of work and high unemployment and all these new problems. And I end up, of course, the pandemic, trying to get the daily case numbers under control and trying to figure out what the science was there. And, so all of those things combined really kind of helped shape my current political beliefs. And, I'm with a job like mine, you're definitely kind of forced to, throw yourself in and, pick a political stance most days. But, overall, I'm definitely dissatisfied with the state of the national politics. I don't think that it's like a right left problem per se. I think it's just more of a power problem. I think it's a institutional problem really, where I don't think that, whoever gets elected president, I don't really think that they have the power to really make all that effective change, because I just think that it seems like whoever gets elected kind of do the same things as their predecessor has done. And that's just one trend that I've kind of noticed over the past few administrations. But I'm not a really hyper-political guy. I really don't, you know, see a lot of value in following the talking heads on the news. I think the more that we can, you know, try to talk to one another and understand different perspectives, like, that's the best way to learn new things and, you know, really cement your understanding of politics. And I'm a big economic geek, so I love, you know, economic theory. I love monetary policy and, you know, seeing where, and I will say I'm not very optimistic where we're at on that regard, just because I think no matter who's in office, it seems like the fiscal, you know, problem keeps getting worse and worse. But yes, that's kind of, you know, where I stand and kind of how I got to where I am today. I definitely consider myself more of a libertarian. I know that's a very, it seems like it's kind of a catch-all term, right, for people who don't identify as a Republican or Democrat, or maybe they're a Republican who, you know, maybe not as far right on some issue, whatever you want to describe it as. But overall, I would just describe my own political ideology as, you know, I'm pro decentralization, pro localized government, you know, put power closer to the hands of the people and really just make a government that's, you know, responsive again and that can be held accountable. I just think that's something that's really been lost in the past decades, I guess.
So, yeah, definitely. I love that mindset. So one of the things you had mentioned earlier was about how basically, like, your mindset has changed throughout education and just life experiences. I'm curious, like, what specific topics sort of, I guess, changed for you in that regard?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, like I mentioned, being raised, you know, very conservative, bringing Fox News and, you know, Rush Limbaugh, I'm airing all hours of the day. I think probably my biggest single issue was just war in general, the war on terror, and you know, what, you know, foreign policy really means. You know, growing up in the, you know, early 2000s, you know, America's been at war for probably 90% of our lives. And I definitely don't think that was something that was ever intended by the founding fathers. I think that it is a way to keep people at the top in power. And I think that, you know, a lot of the fear mongering that goes on for people, you know, who live in different countries halfway across the world, you know, that some people that we perceive as threats to our freedom, you know, I think, you know, my biggest change of thinking was realizing that, hey, maybe they're just pissed off that we're over there and we won't leave, you know?
Yeah, you had even mentioned, like, you're an economics guy too. Like, what is your opinion on our defense budget?
Yeah, no, that is a big, that is definitely a big sticking point for me. That's kind of what made me realize that it's astronomical, you know, totally unnecessary. I think that America has a military base in about 200 countries around the world, which just doesn't make any sense, you know, why we need to be the world's policeman to me. I think that it's not good to spread ourselves too thin, because I think it really hurts us if we ever do need our military to be, you know, defend ourselves against a foreign attack. So, yeah, I think just being spread too thin is bad, and it's just in the long term of things, like, it just, it's probably the single biggest issue that leads to our high deficit. You know, we can, a lot of people like to talk about entitlement programs and all those things, but yeah, I think before anything else, you definitely got to address the defense budget. I think is just totally out of control, so.
Mm-hmm. Where do you think the issue with the spending kind of started at? A lot of people seem to have a lot of opinions, you know, talking about things like Citizens United or you know, basically kind of just placating to certain donors as opposed to helping the American people. I mean, where does your opinion fall in that, in terms of like how you see the problem starting and how you see it manifesting over time?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think it really just, and I don't know if I have a good answer to that. Mm-hmm. I think that really it's the ultimate responsibility, I think, falls on the institutions of Congress. Because, you know, constitutionally to some extent, and I don't know all the details of Citizens United, but I know basically that, it ruled that, donating, and corporations specifically donating to political campaigns, is First Amendment protected free speech. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what the limits are and what should the limits be, you know, I think can definitely be debated, but I definitely think that, you know, Americans, as a right, as a collective, have the right to donate to political candidates who they want through groups, through organizations. I definitely think that that's a right that we have. But I totally support, you know, reforms in that area. I think that the burden falls on the institutions of our government to, you know, pass laws that regulate it further. There should be an overarching, you know, ethics commission that, you know, laws passed that make it more transparent and see where is the money coming from, you know. Mm-hmm. I think anyone who's in office who gets elected, you know, through these large contributions should definitely be accountable to disclosing who their, you know, donors are. I don't think that there's anything wrong with that. So I think that I can't really say where that issue started mm-hmm. as far as the campaign side of things, but I definitely think the answer to it is just more transparency, you know, more oversight from an ethical perspective. I definitely think that burden falls, you know, on the government itself. I don't really think that, you know, average citizens should be should have their right to, you know, have their voice heard by donating their, you know, finances to a political campaign. So, I don't know if that's really the answer you were looking for, but I think that,
No, I think it's a good point. I think what I was trying to get at was, at least in my mind, it seems that a lot of the issues with spending comes with, you know, our government prioritizing certain things over others. And what I mean by that is, like, just looking at a basic example, with the last stimulus package that was recently passed, you know, giving the American people an abysmal $600 while it's giving, you know, millions upon millions to museums that are hardly ever open, you know, other countries. And one thing that I really did appreciate that Donald Trump did, and, you know, during his last few months in office, was basically detailing what was in this bill, because of course on the media, you know, they're saying, oh, it's the $600 you've been looking for, yada yada. But what I really appreciated that he did was like, hey, there's money in this for the Smithsonian, it's not open right now, that, you know, like I just, what was your opinion on that, and especially like the last stimulus package?
Yeah, no, I total outrage, I guess would be the best way to describe it. And also, like, yeah, the museums and kind of the public institutions were one thing. I would say the thing that really grinded my gears is just how many billions of dollars that we're shoveling out to all these foreign countries rather than invest it, you know, here in our own citizens. And I don't know what the exact figure is, but I know for the price tag of whatever that stimulus package was, every American family could get well over, you know, $30,000 or $40,000 each. So yeah, that's where like the $600 a piece definitely is it seemed like a slap in the face. Mm-hmm. For sure. And you know, most like fiscally conservative people, myself included, you know, we don't usually support the idea of federal stimulus. Mm-hmm. But if you're gonna have federal stimulus, then, you know, giving to the people is definitely by far the most effective way. It's Yeah, it's just, I don't know. It was very outraging. And like the other thing that I was really angered by was that during the entire course of the pandemic and when they're having these debates, one thing that was never really mentioned or even brought to the table was the possibility of cutting taxes for, you know, Americans who lost their job or been impacted by the pandemic, or, you know, just average Americans who are still forced to pay their yearly income taxes. And, you know, that was pretty outrageous to me, for the main reason that the entire fiscal stimulus package it's not financed by tax dollars. A lot of people think, you know, it's money that we have sitting in the treasury, but it was all just printed by the Federal Reserve. It was just printed as debt. And, you know, other countries and people around the world buy that debt via U.S. bonds. But that's really debt that we're just kind of enslaving future generations to being forced to pay back. And I think that next year, or sometime within the next 2 years, it's projected that just the annual debt payments, or the annual interest payments on that debt, will be greater than the annual GDP in America. And that was one figure that really stuck with me. So I just think it's just totally irresponsible. And also just the process on how it was done made it, I think, even more outrageous to me, because like I talked about, I'm a big advocate of the legislative process and, you know, making things more transparent. But it was like they printed off this, you know, 30, 40, 50,000 page bill in the middle of the night. And before anyone has a chance to read it, they already have to vote on it, and they're not allowed to, you know, add any amendments on the floor or even speak to it. They just have to vote up or down. And they suspend all the rules that say that you have 24 hours or whatever to read the bill before you vote on it. So that was the really angering thing, is that all these congressmen and senators, they voted for something that none of them had even read to see what was in it. And kind of scary times. Kind of makes, you know, a little paranoid, I guess, on where the future's headed in that direction. But I'm also generally a pretty optimistic guy, and I think there's, you know, kind of the human spirit is to adapt to our circumstances, and I think we will find a way to do that. I don't know if the answer is cryptocurrency or you know, going back to the gold standard. I don't really know what the answer is. Starting from scratch. who knows? But it's certainly kind of troubling times we're living in now.
Yeah. So what I love most about my libertarian friends, and unfortunately it can be kind of a caveat as well, but you guys do not remain loyal to either side. You give flack where flack is due, and I really appreciate people like that. We had 4 years predominantly Republican rule, Donald Trump and House and the Senate. Looking back, how would you review it? What did you like? What did you not like? What would you say to that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's something I've, you know, put a little more thought in recently. Ultimately, I think that Trump left office left it in a worse place than where he found it. And I don't think that it was unique to Trump. I think Obama did the same thing. I think Bush did the same thing. I think Clinton did the same thing. And I think Biden will probably also do the same thing. If I were to, make a prediction. I don't, he really was, he was definitely more of a populist. So one thing Donald Trump did that I think will have a lasting impact on American politics was he totally reshaped the Republican Party. And really, uniting just certainly a lot more working class people who previously maybe weren't involved in the political process. Because kind of the Republican Party establishment for years had been losing on all their main points because there really wasn't that much separating them from the Democratic Party at the point. And I think in 2016 and 2020, we saw really a real appetite for a more populist message. Mm-hmm. And we saw that with Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. I think that, you know, Bernie and Trump really weren't as different as some people think they are,
yeah.
Especially on the economic front. I definitely did not like Trump's economic policies. I think, you know, it's kind of funny because, especially right now, I feel like there's a big debate on, you know, is socialism good or bad, or, you know, what's the future of socialism, and, you know, how does it, how should we use it to address our, you know, current problems? And I think that, you know, a lot of people who supported Trump were very against the socialist message and they against socialist programs. But I really think that Trump had kind of a socialist worldview on the economy. And we kind of saw that with his use of tariffs on foreign products and restricting free trade and also just raising the deficit to incredible amounts. I mean, mm-hmm. Trump was certainly not afraid of spending more money. And I do think I will say some things I liked about Trump was that he did put a spotlight on our problems with foreign policy, both with the wars in the Middle East, and however I do think he gave it more lip service than he actually, you know, made action on on it. I think that you know, he at least brought attention to the fact that, you know, we've been over there for two decades and it's time that we need to come home. But at the same time, I think he probably could have done more to end the wars that are going on and end a lot of those conflicts over there. But also just kind of on the trade part, I do really like that he wasn't afraid to stand up to China. And I feel like America has been taken advantage of by a lot of other foreign governments for a long time. And I think that the American first message really did resonate with a lot of people, and myself included. I really liked kind of the American first message. To me, what it means is not, you know, America's better than everyone else. We need to dominate, you know, everywhere else. To me, it more means that, you know, we can really have a positive influence on the world by leading by example, mm-hmm. and by using our economic power for good. And, you know, establishing good trade relationships and things that benefit American interests and American, you know, companies and jobs. So I like that he really lowered the unemployment rate before the pandemic started. You know, I think that was a good plus. But it all ultimately goes back to the main point that I believe is that he really left office in a worse shape than he found it. But I don't know. You know, it's, I guess history will be the real judge, and, you know, maybe we'll look back. And I remember when Bush left office, he was incredibly unpopular. You know, nobody liked Bush when Obama got elected, and now he seems like he's a pretty popular guy. But so I don't know how history will remember Donald Trump. But I guess that's something that only time will tell.
Yeah. I'm curious. You don't have to share if you don't want to, but I'm curious, did you vote?
Sure.
Who did you vote for both in 2016 and 2020?
Yeah, that's a good question. I voted third party both times. And, you know, so a lot of people say that voting third party is a protest, or, you know, it's a protest vote. It's I get a lot of flack for it from both of my friends on each side of the aisle, because they think, you know, it is kind of funny to me, because they think if I were not to vote for a third party, I would vote for their guy. Mm-hmm. To me, it's not a waste of a vote if you're really voting for the person who you think is going to do the best job and, you know, the things that you most closely align with. That'll never be a wasted vote to me. Mm-hmm. Overall, like, I do think that voting matters, but at least on the federal level, you know, I don't know just because of kind of the duopoly system that we have, and the influence of the two major political parties, I really don't think that voting does a whole lot to change the way things are on the federal level. I think that a lot of it, you know, if we want to see change in our national government, I think the best way is you know, grassroots advocacy, you know, go door to door for an issue or a candidate who you support. You know, I think a good answer to our problems is really just let the states lead by example. You know, you know, what California thinks is best for California is a lot different than, you know, Kentucky. You know, what Kentucky thinks is best for Kentucky. And I don't think that there should be like a federal government really, you know, mandating what's best for the whole country. To answer your question, I did vote a third party, and I'll probably continue to, at least for the time being.
No, that's great. I know. I think I always advocate that a candidate really has to earn your vote. You don't just vote someone, even if you do identify as more of like a liberal Democrat or a conservative Republican. Your candidate has to speak to you. And I think you're exactly of the right mindset to where, you know, we maybe should start to, and you know, the numbers kind of support this as well. We should start to consider, you know, more third party optional candidates that we can get in there to really kind of, not shake things up, but maybe just add a different perspective that's not being considered. So
totally agree.
Final kind of thought / question I kind of want to ask you, because again, you know, aside from the gridlock we're seeing in our federal government and previous comments made by Biden, let's say Biden invites you, Jack, to sit with him in the Oval Office, and he seriously wants to consider different plans or ideas you have in your head of what you would like to see accomplished under a Biden presidency. What are some things that you would share with him?
Ooh, great question. I would say, let's get back to the gold standard. That'd be the first thing, you know, solve the fiscal, emergency that we're in right now. And I would tell him to end the wars in the Middle East. I would tell him, you know, we need to really, you know, get our education system significantly upgraded. I'm a big proponent of school choice, you know, opening up as many education opportunities as we can. That's in the K through 12. Area, but also on the issue of higher education. I mean, there's got to be something to be done on the issue of college tuition and how much money that these institutions get from the federal government. And I think that if they're going to continue to charge, you know, outrageous prices for college tuition, they shouldn't be getting subsidized at all. So I think, you know, education is a huge issue. Healthcare is a huge issue. Another heavily subsidized industry by the government, you know. We've got the Affordable Care Act is clearly a very hot button issue. You know, do we require, you know, coverage for pre-existing conditions or not? You know, what's the individual mandate? And I don't even really know all the ins and outs of that law, but, you know, I think the more things that we can do to, make the pricing model of healthcare more transparent, the better. I'm a big proponent of health savings accounts. It's a tax-free account that you can have to better prepare yourselves for medical issues. I don't think that, you know, I personally don't believe healthcare or health insurance should be, required by everyone. Just because for like your standard checkup and pretty like basic, you know, medical procedures at the doctor, like you shouldn't really need insurance to, you know, pay out of pocket for a pretty standard procedure that doesn't cost that much. But it's just really the cost of those two industries that really need to come under control. So I think just, you know, more transparency and, you know, more competition, I think would really go a long way in fixing those. But Yes, I guess that's those would be my top four.
That was a very good top four. Well, thank you again, Jack, so much for coming on and sharing your thoughts. I know I've really appreciated this conversation. So again, just really want to thank you for coming on.
Yeah, likewise, Lane. Thanks for what you do and hosting this program. You know, I think it's really great that you really provide an unbiased platform for people to share their thoughts and really spread. Give people a platform to spread their voice and learn a little bit more about these issues that our country's facing. So thanks again.
Thanks, Jack. All right, thanks for listening, guys. Bye.
Yep. Bye.